of Crave, a podcast about films, music, television, and anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe over the last week.
We'll be talking about the latest in the Marvel Comics oeuvre, Fantastic Four. Simon's been getting involved in the live music scene in Ponsonby.
While Steve's just been watching concerts this week.
And Coronation Street, does it still have legs after all these years?
Right, let's get into some films first. This week, Steve, Fantastic Four, or just Four?
Fantastic Four, yes. When you put words like fantastic in the title of a film, and obviously there's a reason they're doing that in this case, you're inviting criticism like what we're about to engage in, I think, to be honest. The film is a fairly nuts and bolts, fairly rudimentary, fairly by-the-numbers origin story for the titular Fantastic Four, who have been a Marvel standby for years. And it's hard to know what to make of a film that the director himself has disowned, which is pretty harsh, really. But several days ago, on the 6th of August, Josh Trank, the director himself, tweeted, "A year ago, I had a fantastic version of this, and it would have received great reviews. You'll probably never see it. That's reality, though." Now, he deleted that tweet very shortly afterwards, but that's the context within which you have to see this film.
Yeah, I think, like you, it didn't work. It felt like a pretty middling, at best, entry in these superhero films we're seeing in recent years. I'm quite familiar, Steve, with the Marvel comics. I grew up with them, so I know that they've made an effort to try and update the story for the 21st century.
But we don't give marks for effort, do we?
No, we
want to see quality films.
Yeah, and, you know, they've made changed some characters from the original white European guys to black guys. In the original comic book, they gained their powers because they took a space rocket into space and were bombarded by cosmic rays, whatever they are. Here, in this case, it's all to do with interdimensional travel. But even then, it doesn't really explain how these strange powers came about.
No, of course not. Yeah, the science teacher in me could at least tolerate cosmic rays. They are actually a thing, even if they don't cause these so-called powers. There's no such thing as another dimension. You should never let a physics teacher watch a film like this anyway. But it's utter nonsense. We know that the setup is absolute twaddle. But can we at least give it the benefit of the doubt and suspend disbelief?
Yes, yes. And I think also, Steve, in terms of the disbelief, there's a lot of trying to cram too much into one story. If you were familiar with this from way back, you'd have some sense of where it was going. But I wonder if you weren't, there are a lot of characters they were trying to get you to be familiar with. And I think that that was too tall an order. Just too much crammed in. And just a little comment. There was just a few years back, another version of the Fantastic Four was produced. They did two films, and they really struggled with how to portray this big orange rock man called The Thing.
Yes.
And that a couple of years back, they picked a very short actor to play that role. It's meant to be the Thing is meant to be 6 or 7 or 8 feet tall and huge and powerful and strong. In the previous film, they just took the short actor, and it looked like they put him in a rubber suit. But this time they just went for the full CGI. I don't know what you thought. I still think he didn't look right.
Didn't look rocky enough, did he?
He was naked. What was going on with that?
Well, yeah, you try finding a pair of underpants big enough to fit the thing. It's not going to happen.
But no,
at the very least, I wanted to hear sound effects. You want to hear rocks grinding against stones with this guy. No, it was weak, wasn't it? It was disappointing.
It was disappointing. You just have to put it up. The other thing to bear in mind here for people who are not following these superhero movies, they're more than one studio putting these things out. there's been a whole string of them put out by Marvel Studios. This is the Iron Mans and the Thors and the Avengers, and they've generally been very commercially successful and generally been quite critically well received. They've got quite a heavy dose of humour and not taking themselves too seriously. I don't think this film achieved that at all.
No, it didn't. It's interesting that you comment that you thought they were trying to cram too much in, because unusually for films of this ilk, it was remarkably short. It was an hour and 40 minutes. These things tend to go on for an hour longer than that. And so they're trying to fling so much in a very short time. And yet I thought the first half an hour, 45 minutes, was loose and baggy and very, very badly put together.
Yeah, I think they were trying to give us time to get to know and love the characters, but it didn't work.
No, it didn't.
Steve, what do you think about that? Would you be shouting me a ticket to go and see that film?
I'd be waiting for someone else to buy me a ticket for that one. I don't think I'd pay to see it myself.
I have to say, having sat through them, I've seen a few of these superhero films, so I've got something to compare it with. It's definitely, sadly, one of the weaker ones in this genre of recent times. So, Steve and I are not too pleased with all that. Right, where are we heading next, Steve?
Next, we're going to take a look at Trainwreck, which is the new Amy Schumer vehicle. It's her first feature film. She's been doing TV until now, but now she's made her way into the cinema. Trainwreck. Does it live up to its title?
I didn't think it was a train wreck at all. I didn't know much about Amy Schumer, Steve. I knew she was had done some stand-up comedy. I knew the film was put together by the same people who did the Bridesmaids comedy, which was a successful film a few years back. So I thought, well, this is probably going to be of a pretty decent standard. I thought there were some very funny scenes in it. It's quite crude, quite sharp at times. It is a romantic comedy, so you kind of know where that you're going to be ending up in this film. There's not too many surprises in that. But along the way, some quite nice little scenes, real laugh-out-loud scenes, and it's peppered with some very interesting cameo performances from all sorts of people.
Yes.
From one of the most famous American athletes, the basketballer LeBron James.
Who was, to be fair, probably the highlight of the film.
Yeah, he was quite good as himself, wasn't he?
He was fantastic.
Yes.
And I would wonder, obviously he wasn't actually himself, he's playing a character called LeBron James. I doubt the real LeBron is actually quite as tight with his cash as the character that's a running gag through the film. But he was one of the most engaging presences on the screen, really.
He was good. And there's some real surprises with these other people.
Yes.
I didn't expect to see Daniel Radcliffe pop up.
No.
And what was Chris Evert, the famous and hugely successful tennis player, doing in a film like that? So
she was making a cameo with Matthew Broderick.
Yes, I know. So that kept you on your toes all the way through. Also, there was quite a lot of talk in the film referencing the music of Billy Joel.
Yes.
And he's a New York lad through and through, and I kept thinking, are we going to see Billy Joel? Is he going to pop up somewhere? I half expected he would.
You know, given the number of cameos that did pop up, it's entirely possible that we missed him.
It is, you're right. He could have strayed into shot somewhere.
He quite possibly did.
What did you make of it, Steve?
Well, yes and no. The title sort of suggests it's going to be more in the vein of what Judd Apatow, the director, usually turns out, the really nasty, the really gross out, as it's often referred to, really filthy, vulgar comedy. Bridesmaids was a good example of that. And that's often what Apatow turns out. They didn't quite have the courage of their convictions. It started off fantastic. She's a failure of a human being. She's the train wreck of the title. She's a woman who is so desperate for affection because her father was a bit of a wastrel that she'll sleep with anybody, and she's ashamed of who she is. And it starts off in that vein, and then can't quite pull it off, and so then starts just drifting off into being a romantic comedy, because, well, that's what you do, isn't it? And when it managed to pull itself together and be filthy and vulgar and horrible and crude and nasty, it was funny. But as the film dragged on, and it did drag, let's be fair, it's over 2 hours.
Yeah, I agree with that. I certainly felt I was mostly enjoying it, but I definitely thought, no, you could have taken half an hour out of this and it would have been all the better for it.
And I would suggest the half hour that they take out would be the half hour of rather cheesy, rather schmaltzy family backstory that really had no place in the film. They didn't really earn the right to the attempt at emotional string pulling that they tried to get away with. They should have stuck with, we are a crude, foul, nasty little film, and it would have been very, very funny.
I guess, Steve, what do you think about the way they opened the film, though? The very first scene is a flashback to the two sisters as young girls and their father explaining the divorce of the parents and using this metaphor of what they think about their dolls. I thought that worked pretty well. So I suppose that was the attempt to try and give it some sort of foundation of a family setting.
You're absolutely right. That was a wonderful opening. And had they kept that level of engagement with the father and the sister, it would have worked really well. But this was not a good family drama, family comedy drama that they were trying to shoot for. That was the extent to which, for me, the film failed. For example, Tilda Swinton, who turns in the most astonishing performance as Amy, the title character's boss, is on screen. You can't take your eyes off her. She was awful. She was profoundly unpleasant and exquisite to watch with it. I didn't actually recognise her until the credits rolled at the end. She was fantastic. When it was hitting those notes, I love this film. But then there were too many times, especially toward the end, I was thinking, oh God, what are they doing now? Why aren't they wrapping this up? Please start to tie it together. Instead, they were going off in brand new tangents. And I'm thinking, no, it's time to call it quits.
And what's going on here then, Steve? I'm just listening to you say that. It makes me think, you know, here's Amy Schumer. She's a youngish woman. She's made a name for herself doing pretty in-your-face stand-up comedy.
Yes.
And there's some of that in this film, but as you say, there's some of that more traditional mainstream rom-com going on. She's not going to end up like another Steve Martin who started off really zany and quirky and weird and ended up doing really schmaltzy, happy sort of middle-of-the-road comedies. Well, you dare we think such a thing?
It's a fantastic analogy. You can almost trace her entire career arc in those terms within the 2 hours and some of this film, can't you? If she could ever reach the dizzy heights of Steve Martin, you can almost forgive her hitting the lows that he's perpetrated lately. Because, yes, Steve Martin was obviously was advisedly, an absolute comic genius. And, yeah, it would be a sin to see her go the same way. I think that basically the problem was her very first film, I don't think she quite had the nerve to maintain the foul and filthy momentum. If she had, we would have had a much better film.
I think you're right. Overall, though, I still think I would say to someone, it's worth seeing. You and I might differ on this. I think some of the laugh out loud moments really were great.
Yes.
And I would recommend people go along just for that, although it is too long.
Yes. So tell me, Simon, would you buy a ticket for this?
I actually think I probably would, yes.
Yeah, I think I would, but I'd wait till Tuesday night when the tickets are a bit cheaper.
Let's turn to music. By the way, and just if you've just joined the podcast, this is Crave. I'm Simon Mercep, and he's Steve McCabe, and this is our pretty regular look at all sorts of entertainment which we've sampled and which we want to tell you about. So, music. Now, lately, I live not too far from the central Auckland area around that Ponsonby, Westmere, Greyland area, and it's where I grew up, and there's lots of live music, has been for years, in that area. Just recently, there's a cafe on Ponsonby Road called Cafe 121. That's the numbers 121. Which has had a strong reputation for hosting live music, one of many in the area. And I popped in there just the other week during a live open mic session to see a group calling themselves Group Therapy. It turns out the group therapy is for them, not the audience. It was on this Wednesday night.
Well, I have to ask, at the end of the show, did the audience need group therapy?
Well, the thing is, there were more of the group than the audience.
Oh, wonderful.
So, yes. However, they were great. It was just a bunch of ordinary guys that got together and obviously rehearsed for a period of time and a fairly decent level of musicianship. What was interesting was they rattled through probably an hour and a half of material, and 90% of it was original songs.
Oh, wow.
which I thought was interesting. Just an interesting little snapshot of what actually goes on around the traps these days. This isn't a top line act. I hope they're not offended by me saying that. They're just kind of amateur people, but they're enjoying it very much, and they're writing about what's going on about them. The songs cover the state of the Auckland house prices, ride on the Waiheke ferry, what it's like to be in Hamilton by Ooh. Comparison, all sorts of just local stuff. But it was an enjoyable way to spend an hour and just realise that if you can take the time, and if you've got the time, you can make the effort to get out and about. There's actually a lot of live entertainment around the scene, and I guess in a bigger city like Auckland more so. But even I know through all the time interviews I've done with musicians on the afternoons program, there are wonderful musicians all around the country getting out and about performing. So we've all got no excuse not to get out and enjoy it.
Not everything happens at the Vector Arena, does it?
And that is absolutely right. That's not to say we should ignore the Victor Arena, because we should try on that too.
I'm led to believe there's a degree of audience participation at Cafe 121.
Yes. Well, as it happened, Mr. McCabe, amongst the guests, there was a visiting academic. I went there with some friends from AUT and here in Auckland, and one of them is a visitor from a Norwegian university. And he popped up and just borrowed a guitar and did a couple of songs. The second song he did was a Bruce Springsteen song.
A Bruce Springsteen song, you say?
Could you imagine it? And me being a Springsteen fan since the age of 18, he said, come on, come up and sing it with me, which I couldn't refuse. So we both got up there, and neither of us had ever sung a song together before, but we both knew the lyrics to the song, Promised Land, and we just tootled along and belted it out. And I thought, what was interesting about it was that we're both from, you know, different sides of the planet, never got together to perform in any way, shape, or form ever before. But because we both knew this guy, the music of Springsteen, it worked.
That's just the power of Bruce, isn't it?
It is the power of Bruce.
The power
of Bruce.
The
title of a book. Anyway.
So I'm hoping that somebody videoed this. This must be on YouTube by now. Please tell me it is.
It was certainly photographed. There were clips. I don't know if the whole performance was videoed. I will actually follow that up. If it's of any decent standard, who knows where it might go.
If we manage to get hold of some video, we'll make sure we link to it on our website, cravepodcast.com. We'll make sure that the whole world knows about it.
Thank you so much. This could be the start of something big. Anyway, what music, Steve McCabe, have you been partaking of lately?
Well, I found myself purely by chance seeing a local band recently, two nights in the same week, a band called Swamp Thing. They are a Rotorua act who describe themselves as a two-man blues juggernaut. Now, that's their words. Okay. What I've seen is two fellas who perform some quite remarkable, filthy, swampy, is definitely a word for them, loud, noisy, and very enjoyable blues-influenced rock. It's two guys, Michael Barker and Grant Hauer, as I say, from Rotorua. Two-man blues outfits, but they put together a noise that does not suggest just two performers. They're brilliant. I was very, very impressed. I stumbled across them when they were opening for the John Spencer Blues Explosion at the Power Station. Now, I wrote a review of John Spencer and got a lot of grief from his fans for saying he wasn't particularly good. One of the cardinal rules of reviewing music is never criticise my favourite band. And I broke that cardinal rule, apparently, and I got a lot of grief for it. But I didn't care, because what I did do was point out that their opening act, Swamp Thing, were very, very good, and I'd be very interested in seeing them again. Lo and behold, on Friday night of that week, I was down at the Tuning Fork in Auckland, next door to the Vector Arena, where Swamp Thing were opening for the Waratahs.
Ah, okay.
And the Waratahs were every bit the pleasant, enjoyable, agreeable act that they were always going to be. There was never going to be anything exciting and innovative about their music. But Swamp Thing, again, were excellent. Michael Barker in particular, their drummer, does much of the show playing his drums one-handed, while his left hand picks out melodies on the keyboards. He's quite a remarkably talented fellow. Apparently a classically trained percussionist. Originally, he's played with people like Split Enz in the past. But then, after they came off stage and the Waratahs came on, he was sitting behind the merchandise stall selling Swamp Thing DVDs. So I took the opportunity to have a quick chat with the man. He's a very, very charming individual. And I was sold. I was very, very impressed. It was some of the most enjoyable new music I've heard in quite some time. They are doing occasional appearances across the North Island and even venturing down south to the mainland from time to time over the remainder of the year. If you get a chance, check them out. They are very, very good. Swamp Thing.
Fantastic. So just to make sure I understand this, so you've got the drummer who's also playing keyboards.
Correct.
And then the other musician, is he playing guitar or bass?
He's playing guitar. Grant Howard is their guitarist. Like I say, from Rotorua, but you think via New Orleans or Chicago or somewhere. He has a wonderfully rich, resonant blues roar. He's amazing.
Fantastic. All right, that's Swamp Thing. And here's, in our first episode, Steve, I drew a preposterous link between Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible and a German film about the attempted assassination of Hitler. There is another preposterous link we can draw.
Go on.
Well, we started off talking about the Fantastic Four, which of course is based on a comic book. And Swamp Thing
was
a famous comic book of the 1970s, a horror creature from the swamp, like the lagoon.
Yes.
Yes, there we are. I think it was a DC comic, I think. I'm not sure about that. Anyway, you can find links wherever you need to find them. right, so we've looked at on Ponsonby Road at Cafe 121, a little impromptu group called Group Therapy, and Steve has also sampled twice Swamp Thing, a fantastic Rotorua-based blues act. This is Crave. That's Steve McCabe and me, Simon Mercer, with a regular podcast looking at music and movies and television and whatever else takes our fancy in the world of entertainment. Steve, I have been considering television in the last few days.
Yes.
And it's television which comes from, I think, pretty close to your neck of the woods back in jolly old England. I'm talking about Coronation Street, which is set in Weatherfield, which is meant to be in or near Manchester, isn't it?
Well, I'm after getting to character here, obviously, and talk proper when I do this, right? Weatherfield is not a real town, obviously. Weatherfield is a fictionalised and slightly romanticised version of Salford, which is where I grew up, which is the city that neighbours Manchester. And this is my childhood we're talking about now. It's the longest-running TV show in the world. It's been going forever, and it's a romanticised, as I say, an idealised. It's a not very realistic, but it's an impression of working class northwest of England, started back in the 1960s, and it's retained a lot of its charm, hasn't it? Really,
I think it probably has. I have of late, because my partner Sharon, she's a big fan, so I, being a dutiful partner, I have been watching some episodes with
good
him
man.
Good man. And, you know, it's still soap operatic. It still has a mix of some fairly heavy storylines, but still quite a degree of humour and levity. And one thing that really struck me about Coronation Street, I remember some years back, I'm not sure if we still have it in New Zealand, we were able to see the BBC's London-based soap opera, EastEnders.
Yes.
And the little that I saw of that, what struck me about that was unrelentingly grim was
yes.
My impression of it, whereas Coronation Street had the light and the shade, and you had an opportunity to take a breather and laugh with a few characters, and they still seem to maintain that mix of storytelling, which I think probably for most audiences, works better, because I think EastEnders just got a bit too unremittingly,
Unremitting is a great word for it. It was relentlessly grim and oppressive, and you could just imagine every story meeting, every scriptwriter's meeting they had, is like, what social issue can we fling at it next? We've had single mothers, we've had gays, we've had immigrants. Yeah, we'll do an immigrant. How about a gay immigrant, single mother? Let's do them all. Can we kill them? Oh, definitely yes. And they were just flinging as many problems as they possibly could, and it was relentless. It was.
Yes.
It was oppressive. Coronation Street has always managed to have a little bit of, as you say, light and shade. It's never a comedy, obviously. It's never been a sitcom. But it's always had light relief. You could breathe. You could relax. Some of the most beautiful characters that have ever been written in British television. Hilda Ogden remains one of the finest ever. She was a joy to watch. Jean Alexander, who played her, was a marvellous actress. It was a joy of a show.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's grown over the years. I've not watched it a whole lot since I left England in 1991. I've kept up with some of the characters. But obviously, it's moved on. I realised when I last started watching it, I didn't recognise half of the characters. Because it's a living thing. It's growing, it's progressing, but it's still got that heart that underpins it. It's got warmth, it's got joy. Even in the grindingly grim, relentless grimness of up north and the satanic mills of Lancashire, it's still got joy and humour because we're much nicer up north than those miserable buggers down south.
Right. Look, there's one aspect of it I would just be interested in your view of, because it was shown in New Zealand very early on, Steve. I mean, I think even in the early 60s it was being shown here. And in those days, in the black and white TV we watched, at the Rover's Return, and I still remember the names, Annie Walker.
Oh, yes.
Jack Walker and Ina Sharples.
Wow, we are going back here, aren't we?
Yeah, but their characters were all white English people. Sure they were. At some point, I don't know exactly when, we started to get representatives from some of the other communities in the UK. And now it's really quite a mixed bag of people from all sorts of backgrounds, clearly all speaking with the same accent, of course. But I just wondered, I'm not sure that you said how recently you've been back to Salford, but do what we see on Coronation Street, is that a fair representation of what that part of England is like these days, do you think?
Very much so. As I was growing up in that part of the world back in the 80s, and I left in 91, what we saw on TV did reasonably reflect what we saw on the streets of Salford at that time. England's always had a large immigrant community from its various colonies. And as immigrant communities often tend to go, you often got pockets. And so you would find in particular, for example, the Southeast Asian community or the Indian and Pakistani and Bangladeshi community would often be over the other side of the Pennines in Yorkshire, in places like Bradford. Less so in Manchester. And so the characters that we're seeing were largely white and working class, because that's what you found in that particular part of the world. I don't think there was ever an attempt to exclude certain races or certain demographics. It was simply that if you're attempting to reflect what you're seeing in Salford, what you're mostly going to see is the likes of your Ina Sharples and your Stan Ogdens. They were the characters that you would see down a pub like the Rovers most evenings. And so it was fairly authentic. But over the years, with the population of cities like Manchester and Salford has started to diversify. An immigrant community has started to develop. And as a result, it makes absolutely perfect sense that those characters start to show up in the shows that reflect those communities. It's totally reasonable and it's done quite well.
Well, look, anyway, so there's a lot to talk about Coronation Street. Decades old, still going strong. I'm not sure what its ratings are like in the UK, but I'm guessing it's still pretty popular over there.
Oh, it's fantastically popular. It will never go away. And just to bring this back to our original topics, are you familiar with the well-known 1960s music tie-in with Coronation Street?
Oh, no.
Are you by any chance a Monkees fan?
I know something of the Monkees, yes, keep talking.
Were you aware that Davy Jones has appeared in Coronation Street? He's a Lancashire lad.
Oh, okay, fantastic. Oh, okay, that's a great, actually, now that you say that, I think my memory is ticking over and I think I can recall discussion about this in the past.
Yes.
Another link.
He was never a major character, but he was definitely in there. So next time you're listening to Last Train to Clarksville, you figure, is it leaving from Piccadilly Station or what?
Good stuff. And that is Crave for another week. You can contact us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.